Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how to encourage more women to pursue leadership roles, and in just a moment, some historical context for the media's obsession with a president's first 100 days. But first, speaking of history, we begin today with the next installment in our Culture Cap series, where we take a pressing issue in Phoenix culture and dissect it. To do that, we invite two people who've immersed themselves in the questions that reverberate in the collective consciousness of the Valley here to the studio. And today, we bring you Culture Cap Historical Preservation Edition. My guests this morning are Robert Pala, a longtime KJZZ contributor who's been reporting on these issues as well as undertaking his own preservation and restoration projects for over 30 years. Good morning, Robert.
Hey, Sam.
And I'm also joined by Julia Taggart, who is a relative newcomer, to the world of historical preservation, but who has thrown herself into a wide range of projects all around the Valley. She is, among other things, the president of the Sunny Slope Historical Society and Museum and the youngest museum president in the state. Julia, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here. To start, I wanted to ask you both, and Robert, we'll start with you, to share some physical structure in Phoenix that for you represents your perspective on Phoenix's relationship to its history.
Sure. So I am fortunate enough to live in an Alfred Beadle building in Midtown Phoenix called the Executive Towers. And beautiful. I mean, Alfred Beadle really redefined architecture here in the Valley in the middle of the last century. Beautiful high-rise building. Full of Alfred Beadle touches, including a water feature. So Beadle did this thing where he would incorporate a water feature in the front of his building so that they appeared to be floating. We have a beautiful water feature that has we have a reflecting pond that has a water feature that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. And some people in the building who are on a design committee there, a committee that I am also working with, decided it would be a good idea to remove our water feature and replace it with a garden of plastic plants. And I thought otherwise.
Yeah.
So I objected. But, you know, I'm lucky because we have a really wonderful historic preservation office in Phoenix. And I was able to call them and say, hey, you know, what are my options here? What can you help guide my conversation with these people that I have to live with alongside? We have activists like Roger Brevoort and Allison King who could also advise me and say, you know, here are the limitations of replacing Alfred Beadle's beautiful architectural details with a bunch of philodendrons made of spun petroleum.
Right? So, Julia, what about you? You were agog when Robert brought up the plastic flowers. What is an object for you that...
An object for me would be PV Mall. So that was my childhood mall growing up. It's not PV Mall anymore, as I know you guys just reported about the new restaurants coming in. But the carousel, the Free Graces sculpture, the stained glass pieces, trying to preserve those when it was getting demolished of, you know, finding a good home for them and keeping that history alive and going down the rabbit hole of, you know, what was the meaning behind these different art pieces that affected generations? Because that was my childhood carousel. You know, I always saw that sculpture walking into the mall or the cube, which everybody remembers, that iconic cube. So trying to see what we can preserve with this new development.
So I'm curious to know for both of you, I mean, obviously you have these wonderfully specific relationships with these old pieces of Phoenix architecture. What would you say are the obstacles that you face when it comes to identifying something that needs to be saved, just from a really practical standpoint?
A lot of times it is... a lack of knowledge. Mm-hmm. People don't know what they don't know. So they drive by a really interesting old building and either they don't see it or they think, oh, that's an interesting old building. And that's kind of where the conversation ends. And that's just human nature. I'm not demonizing that thinking. But if you don't care about historic architecture in a general way, and if you don't have a relationship with the building, then the obstacle begins there because you have to begin by educating people.
To follow that, I would say developers. We have many developers coming from out of state that they don't know what our history is. They don't know what they should be saving or what the certain pieces mean. And the public sometimes doesn't know, you know, to ask the Historic Preservation Office, you know, if it can be saved or to work with the developer. A lot of people don't know that there is a City of Phoenix Historic Preservation Office or a State Historic Preservation Office. And you have to educate the developers as well as the public on the history of these pieces and why we need to save them or at least compromise and save what we can.
Yeah, I mean, the phenomenon of Beetle, I think, which you brought up, Robert, is a really interesting way of thinking about this. I was in a restaurant over the weekend, and on the wall, they had these three paintings, and one of them was White Gates, Robert Beetle House. Al Beetle House. Your name is Robert.
It is.
And then they had two other paintings that showed the work of two other architects. And it struck me that, you know, Beetle, as well as a number of other architects from here in the Valley, are part of the iconography of the West. But there is this appreciation that we should put the work on the wall and think about what the work evokes. But then there's this practical concern of how to actually keep it in the actual landscape of the West. And Julia, I wanted to ask you about this if I could, because you, even though, as we mentioned, you're still in your 20s, you've only recently just gotten involved in all of this, but you have recently had a number of breakthroughs. And I wonder if you could talk about those and how you feel you were able to make some progress where for decades there had not been so much progress.
It's really funny because I just don't believe in giving up. I was taught not to give up, so I am very, you know, optimistic and I'll keep going at it. But no, Marion Blake, she had tried for 45 years. She's the owner of the Sunny Slope Rock Garden. And she couldn't get a historic status, and she was sending petitions to the city. She didn't know there was a form she needed to fill out. She doesn't have Wi-Fi or a computer. So we were able to get that after 45 years. Wallace and Ladmo Way, I guess some people from the cast and crew had tried for a street sign for 35 years. They didn't know that there's a form you're supposed to fill out and get it approved by that district office. And I just did that within a couple of months, and we got it, you know, just recently. And just other properties trying to get it historic, just talking with the business owners and letting them know what actually historic preservation is and what the overlay is and what the benefits are to it. You know, so it's a lot of work, but it's really fun and someone has to do it and I don't mind doing it. Mm-hmm. And I get to hear different stories all the time and meet very interesting people and learn about architecture, the culture here, what we used to have. I just recently toured the first TV studio building, KPHO, which is now First Studio, which is an art gallery. And I got to kind of see the behind the scenes of what it was like to have a TV station here. And it was really small, but no, it's really fun to keep going. And I think it's just, you can't give up. You got to keep going for it.
Speaking as someone who's been covering this for decades, she has done more than many historic preservationists and many other activists just in the past 2 years than they've done, these very hardworking people have done in 20 and 30 years. It's kind of astonishing, and she doesn't give up. She is that proverbial dog with the bone on some of these things.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about this, Julia, because I hear you saying that some of this is very practical and matter of fact. There's forms that have to be filled out, and some folks might just not know that that is a piece of infrastructure that exists and that they need to deal with. But there are also these conversations that you alluded to, and I'm struck, Robert, by what you said about the phenomenon of the water feature in a Beetle apartment building like the one you live in, is not just the fact that it's pretty, but it has this effect, as you said, of making it look like the building is floating. And that's a different way of communicating than I think a lot of people have a facility with. So is there anything you could think of, Julia, in these conversations you've had where you felt like you were able to convey something about, for lack of a better word, the soul of something like the Rock Garden?
Yes. No, we did conversations multiple times because there was kind of a concern of, you know, we don't know if we can save this rock garden with the HP overlay. That was the discussion. And I said, it doesn't matter if we can't save it. It matters that she's tried for 45 years. She's dedicated her life to this, that she gets to see this route and she gets to see the City of Phoenix recognize it and to finally get historic status. And we were able to because the rock garden wraps around the house. But it's having those conversations of it has such an important significance, you know, and reaching out with the public whenever we do a property for the city of Phoenix to try and get it historic status, my museum, we engage the public and say, send your comments of support, you know, for Hanson Mortuary, for the Sunny Slope Presbyterian Church, Eye Opener, the Rock Garden, even for other properties, and letting people know that they can voice their opinion and that their opinion does matter. Because your voice does matter, and people love to hear the stories of, you know, what Hanson Mortuary means to them or what the Rock Garden means to them. And it's just having those conversations with business owners and property owners of there are, you know, benefits to historic preservation and your property does matter. That history does matter, and we want to help you preserve it.
Well, I am speaking with Julia Taggart and Robert Pala. This is our Historic Preservation Culture Cap. We will have much more in just a moment. Good morning and welcome back to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman and this is our Wednesday Culture Cap. With me today are Robert Pala, longtime KJZZ contributor, and Julia Taggart, president of the Sunny Slope Historical Society and Museum. Something I heard a lot when I moved to this city that I'd love to get both of your takes on is this idea that Phoenix is a place where people come to reinvent themselves. And implied in that is this idea that it's a place where people want to dissociate from their past, which in my mind lends a particular urgency, perhaps, to the idea of keeping the past alive. Do you agree with that framing of Phoenix as a city, and how does it impact your work?
I'm probably splitting hairs here, but I don't think it's that we or that preservationists are trying to keep the past alive. I think what we're doing is we're trying to keep the past part of the story. And if you knock it over and put up something new, that part of the story is gone. We have really significant architecture here. Not all of it. But we don't want Phoenix to look... I don't think anyone wants Phoenix to look like it rose out of the desert 4 years ago or 20 years ago. We don't want it to reflect just one style of architecture. And if you knock down every single Pueblo building, if you knock over every single mid-century house in Arcadia and replace it with a Tuscan, whatever those things are, then you don't get the full picture of Phoenix. And I think that is distinct from keeping the past alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
I think we're trying to preserve what we have left. We've lost a lot of great buildings like the Fox Theater, which I believe is now a Fry's Marketplace. And how are you supposed to know the history of Phoenix? I know it's a young city to some people, but how are you supposed to know the history of Phoenix if you don't have these properties to show you? If you don't know where we started to how we got to here now, because now we're the fifth largest city in the U.S. or the fourth, I can't remember, you know, and we have this great history of it was a desert and people didn't want to live in the desert. And now everybody wants to live here. So we have to have these properties that can show you the different periods of time in Phoenix's history, whether it's mid-modern century or Victorian or Pueblo. I mean, you have to kind of be able to look back at your history and your past to know what your future is going to be.
Yeah, yeah. The all of a sudden, the Joni Mitchell lyric about paving paradise to put up a parking lot is running through my head.
Right.
But I'm sure you have both dealt with the reality that in some of these cases, you have to compromise. And I think that's sort of contained in what you were alluding to, Robert, this idea that you don't want to lose the story. The story has to move forward, but you want it to be a complete story. So I wonder if both of you could share moments where you had to compromise a little bit in a project you've worked on and how you decided where the points you were willing to give some ground on were.
I'll let you take that first, Robert.
Okay. So I think for me, as someone who covers historic preservation, I can't participate actively because I'm writing about it, and the ethical question comes up then. My contribution is that I cover the Beatrice Moores and the Allison Kings and the Sherry Rampies and Julia Taggart, people who come to me and say, hey, here's the story and this is happening. And what I've learned from watching them is you really have to pick your battles. Mm-hmm. My favorite example of this is the Duke Photography Building.
Yes.
At 7th Avenue and Thomas, right? Mm-hmm. So many of us remember that building because it's where we all went to have our senior portraits taken. Our mothers, our sisters, our, you know, all generations of us, or family portraits when everybody got together to, you know, do that moment in time on film. But the building itself is not interesting or significant. And when the owners sold it a couple of years ago to a developer who I think wanted to put a fried chicken franchise there, my thought was, it's not an important building, it's an important memory, and that is where you have to draw the line.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I would say for me, there's some properties that are too far gone that wouldn't be eligible if the city. So Angel Bavella's house, which is from 1919, an old mining cabin with a fence on it, that's behind a business, you know, that can't be saved. That's going to go into the ground one day. I mean, it's over 100 years old. Or Cloud 9 on top of Shaw Butte. Certain properties you won't be able to preserve, but you can preserve that history, whether it's with an exhibit or doing an interview with K-Jazz or even doing signage there, which we're doing. You can have that sort of compromise. But like he said, you can't save everything and you're not going to win everything, but it does matter to fight and just to try. I think that's what really matters, is that you gave it your all, you know, and that you didn't give up. And people see that and they see it as, you know, I should try too. Even if I don't win, at least I tried.
Yeah. Well, in that vein, one of the reasons I'm really excited to have the two of you in particular on to talk about this today is that, as we've alluded to a couple times in our conversation, Robert, you've been doing this for decades. Julia, you're newer to it, but you both have, if I may, really active, reverberant passion for this. And I'd love to have you compare notes a bit on what it was like to get involved in preservation and restoration work here 30 years ago versus what you felt like you encountered, Julia, coming to it more recently. Robert, maybe we'd start with you for that.
Well, the awareness is what has primarily changed. People are more aware today that we, A, have architectural history and that we have significant architects working now and having worked in the past. When I started covering historic preservation, people didn't necessarily know about Ralph Haver or Alfred Beadle or even Eddie Jones or Wendell Burnett or Jack Black or people who were working currently. And that has changed thanks to people like Beatrice Moore, who decided to invest her own capital in preserving the warehouse district on the west side in downtown Phoenix. And people like Janet Traylor, who took on the beautiful property at Central and, is it Maryland or Missouri? I can never remember.
I think it's Maryland.
Maryland. The Olympus, which is a gorgeous mid-century building, and that is her beat. So the awareness was not there when I started doing this, but thanks to people like Julia, there is a greater awareness, and people know that the buildings are there and what they mean.
For me, it was our small museum, the Sunny Slope Historical Society. It was close to closing. They didn't have many volunteers. People weren't coming in. And one of the founders of the museum spoke out to me and was very concerned about it. So I said I would do whatever I could to help because it's a part of my community. And then seeing all these properties that hadn't been given historic status or even, you know, the light of day of their history, I really wanted to preserve that. And then going out into Phoenix and seeing how else we can help, because that was the whole mission of Sunny Slope, was not just helping people in Sunny Slope, but helping people in Arizona. So whether it's helping with the Clare House in Gilbert or the Velma Teague Library in Glendale, you know, we want to help preserve anything that we can and give our advice and our support to people and, you know, reaching out to the media and working with people like Robert and K-Jazz and other TV and news stations has really helped kind of change the narrative and gotten more people involved. I've had people who have listened to K-Jazz say, I heard you talk about Cloud 9 and I was hoping you could help me with this property in Cave Creek. And I'm like, okay, sure, yeah. You know, I'll try and help however I can. And we were actually able to preserve that property in Cave Creek, too. So it's interesting to see how small the world is.
Well, that speaks to what Robert was alluding to, this idea that if you keep the conversation, you keep the story alive, there's more of an awareness in a place where there is so much development and newness all the time. It just keeps the awareness of the past being part of the story involved. We have just a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask you both, you know, this is sort of a high-stakes question, but would you say that you're fundamentally optimistic or pessimistic about the future of preservation in the Valley?
I've been frightened for a little while because I see that we are people of a certain age, the historic preservationists, and who will we pass this mantle on to? But I'm taking some real hope lately from things like new organizations or new-ish organizations like Preserve Phoenix and new activists like Julia Taggart. I have a gig at Phoenix Home and Garden where they let me write about important buildings. And I was recently interviewing a very young architect who redid a Beetle building that had been vacant for 20 years. And he had more than foundational knowledge. He knew everything that he needed to know to rework and renovate this building so that it still looked like Alfred Beetle. And by the way, the developer renamed the building the Beetle. So things like that, that mm-hmm. a 30-year-old is taking me through a building that he helped design and talking to me about Alfred Beetle, and then the developer, who probably didn't really care about anything other than developing, renamed it the Beetle. Yes, I'm hopeful now.
Julie, what about you?
I'm hopeful. I'm still young. I'm 25, so I still have the energy to keep going, and I'm fairly healthy. But no, I want to keep going, and I see more people getting involved, and more people are getting hope from stories like the Rock Garden or Wallace and Ladmo. And it's just, it takes time, but I think we're getting there. The public cares. The public's coming to meetings. They're voicing their support. We have a lot more to do, but we're going to get it done.
Well, thank you both for joining me today to talk about all this. I've been speaking with Julia Taggart and Robert Pala. This is our Wednesday Culture Cap, and the show will continue in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, what dogs can teach us about Valley Fever. But first, more than a decade ago, Gloria Felt had a question she couldn't figure out the answer to. Why hadn't women reached parity in leadership? Despite making up roughly half the workforce and earning more than half the college degrees, Felt says women had been stuck at comprising about 18% of leadership positions across all sectors for two decades. So Felt, an author and former president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, decided to find answers to that question. That led her to co-found a group called Take the Lead, where the goal is reaching parity by 2025. She talked about this with my co-host, Mark Brody.
I was teaching a course at Arizona State University called Women, Power, and Leadership, which I had made up. And that gave me a really good opportunity to do some research and try to figure out why was this happening. And as I dug into the research, I found that it said things like, well, women just have less ambition than men. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that is not it. There's something else going on. And the more I really looked into it, and I found that there are culturally learned ideas about power and intentionality that are inculcated very differently between boys and girls, men and women. Furthermore, that women would often have a very negative attitude toward power because the traditional narrative of power was fighting, wars, the assumption of scarce resources. Women bore the brunt of the most negative aspects of that kind of power. And why would they want it? So I found that by simply helping women shift how they thought about power from that oppressive idea of power over to a generative idea, innovative, creative idea of power to. The power to make your life better, your family's life better, the community, the world, whatever you wanted to do. And to understand there is no limit to, there's no finite pie of the resources that matter now.
11 years ago, your goal, as you said, was to have more women in leadership positions across various sectors by 2025. How much progress did you make?
Well, we didn't do it by 2025. Well, that was a very ambitious stake in the ground, and we knew it at the time. But I'm a great believer that if you don't put an accountable stake in the ground, you will not get anywhere.
You need a goal,
we
even if you
goal.
Don't know that
we
you can actually hit it.
And so, you know, so we didn't make it by 2025, but we are pushing on to 30%. So that's not bad. That's not bad progress. That's almost doubling. And I truly believe that we're hitting critical mass now and that we're at a place where we can move much farther, much faster for several reasons. Number one, companies have invested a lot in their female employees. Companies need the female talent. Women's purchasing power is phenomenal. So there are so many reasons why I think we can move farther faster. And I don't know exactly what that end date will be, but I think it will happen.
Are there particular sectors where you've seen more success than others?
Yes. I've seen a lot of success in, well, there's been a lot of success in journalism, for example. Mm. So that's one area. There has been some change in the medical field. Women are now over 50% of the medical school students, and so you're seeing vast changes in medicine. You're seeing changes in the political world, where when I started this, Congress was at that 18% mark. Now it is also about 28%. And so there are many different places. This is small potatoes progress, but when I started, women were maybe 3% of the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. Now they are over 10%.
Hmm.
So, you know, you take your progress where you can.
Yeah. What are you seeing in terms of as more and more women are getting the opportunity to have these leadership positions? What are you seeing in terms of pay equity? Because I know that's another big issue. There's a film coming out about Lilly Ledbetter, who is really a pioneer in that area. Are women being paid as equally as men are anymore?
Well, thank you for mentioning Lilly, because she is one of my sheroes. So Lilly was quite a fighter for equal pay, because she discovered, after working for Goodyear Tire and Rubber for 30 years, that she had been being paid 30% less than her male colleagues in the same job with the same experience. The Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act was the first bill that Barack Obama signed into law when he became president. And Lilly never stopped fighting for equal pay. And it has gotten better, but it's still not there. Women are still paid about 18% less for the same job with the same experience.
Does that include in leadership positions also?
That includes every across the board.
Okay.
Now, some of it is built-in bias, because the data shows that men are rewarded based on potential. Women are rewarded based on performance that they can already validate. And a big part of what we try to do at Take the Lead is help women know how to, first of all, know their value, claim their value, and how to ask. And when women do that, they have much more success in getting their fair pay.
I want to ask you about what you have seen over the last 11 years since you started Take the Lead, sort of in a societal and to an extent political sense. Like in 2014, I'm sure you could not have forecast that Donald Trump would be president, for example, twice. You maybe couldn't have forecast that there would have been such an increase in, for example, DEI programs that really tried to, in part, help promote programs specifically for women and other traditionally underrepresented communities. Given where we are right now in 2025, I'm curious what you see going forward with a lot of these programs going away and coming under fire. And at the same time, you know, President Trump does have several women in leadership positions in his administration.
I've had the wonderful experience of seeing that history goes up and down. And so this is not the first time that we have had setbacks. This is not the first, you know, these are things that ebb and flow and go backwards and forwards. And people need to understand that that happens, but it doesn't just happen. People make these things happen. And so we cannot not be engaged and involved in our professions, in our community life. We cannot not be involved. This is of the utmost importance. Whatever your position is really important to be involved, an engaged citizen. No, I couldn't have predicted this, but I could have predicted something would happen.
Mm.
And the last book that I wrote is called Intentioning, which is a word I made up because I wanted intention to be an active verb. It's Intentioning Sex Power Pandemics and How Women Will Take the Lead for Everyone's Good. Well, one of the things I say in the book is there's always going to be something. It may not be a pandemic. There's going to be something that's going to create a disruption. So the point is to take that disruption, take the energy of it, and use it to propel yourself forward. And that is the mindset that I teach women to have. Take that energy, turn it into something positive. How will you do that? Well, people are paying attention right now. So that's your opportunity to state your case.
So in that sense, then, I wonder if you would consider a time like this maybe more important to the causes that you're promoting than maybe even the time in 2014 when you started this operation.
I absolutely think that's correct. But it's not logical. It's not instinctive for people to think that way.
Mm.
You know, instinctively, we back off. Instinctively, you see people wanting to resist. Well, I say resistance is futile. You have to set the agenda yourself. You have to have the vision of where you want to go and articulate that and not be afraid to do that.
All right. Gloria Felt with Take the Lead. Thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Good morning. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. For about a week now, we've been hearing story after story about President Trump's first 100 days in office. We've heard stories about his poll numbers, his policies, his perceived successes and failures. And if you've been following presidential politics for a while, these stories have a familiar ring to them. You may recall similar waves of analysis of the first 100 days of President Trump's first term, or President Obama's, or President Reagan, or Carter, or Nixon, or Kennedy. The fact is, this idea that a president has 100 days to do something consequential goes back almost 100 years. And it can be easy to forget. But with a few exceptions, pretty much every president on that list has fallen short of that benchmark. Yet the expectation persists. So why does this keep happening? Where does this storyline about the first 100 days come from? And is there any reason to believe that President Trump's second first 100 days will be remembered differently than his predecessors? To answer all of these questions, I recently spoke with a professor of public policy at UMass Amherst named Alistair Roberts. Back in 2021, Roberts wrote a piece for Wilson Quarterly called The 100 Days Mistake. And I wanted to know if he was still feeling skeptical about this pesky political narrative.
I think we want to probably distinguish the facts of the 100 days and the myth of the 100 days, and we can talk a bit about that.
Yes.
But the facts of the 100 days basically are rooted in Franklin Roosevelt's first 100 days in office. He was the last president to be inaugurated in March. So he was inaugurated in March 1933. The country was in deep economic and social crisis. And when he gets into the White House, he lays out a plan for legislative action, and there are a little more than a dozen major bills that he sends to Congress to resolve the crisis. Most of those bills are passed by the time that Congress adjourns for the summer. That's roughly a period of about 100 days, and that's the sort of factual predicate for the story we know about the 100 days.
Yes, and as you quote, a columnist of the era, Walter Lippmann, said that it was a time when we found out that the United States, quote, had a government that could govern.
Well, that's right. I mean, there was a widespread sense that the country was on the edge of collapse and broad public support for a president who was ready to sort of act to resolve the crisis. And Roosevelt himself, in his inaugural address, said, It's basically like the country is at war. He said, we face a crisis equal in scale to war.
Well, one of the big things that jumped out at me from your unwinding of the history of the first 100 days, both in the piece that you wrote about this and in the answer that you just gave, is that these measures were passed by Congress, not executive order, which is the standard we've become more familiar with.
Well, that's right. The interesting thing about the Trump 100 days, the period we're in right now, is that there's no legislative program. It's
right.
Qualitatively different. Life was, in a way, simpler back then because, you know, the federal government was smaller. Roosevelt was writing on a clean slate in many ways. He wasn't revising legislation or reforming programs. He was setting things up for the first time. And the second point is that, you know, the country is behind him. There's no effective political opposition at that time. Even Republicans are saying that, you know, there's one Republican member of Congress who says, if ever we needed a dictator, we needed one now. And he's talking about Roosevelt. So,
wow.
You know, there was really, we're in a very different time politically.
So almost every president since Roosevelt has campaigned on some version of a promise of what they're going to accomplish in the first 100 days. And it's basically never worked, right?
You know, there's the fact of the 100 days, what actually happened under Roosevelt. But there's also the myth of the 100 days, which I think is sort of more powerful. And it's the myth that we're dealing with right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the 20, 25 years after Roosevelt, people paid some attention to the 100-day concept, but not much. The idea really got polished by a Harvard professor, a historian named Arthur Schlesinger. in the late 1950s. And he's the one who made it seem like a dramatic episode in American history. And Schlesinger was a key advisor to John Kennedy, and also in the sort of Democratic circle in the early 1960s. So that's when the whole myth comes, the notion that the presidents have to act powerfully in the first 100 days. That's when it really becomes settled. And ironically, this is basically a Democratic invention.
Can you talk a little bit about when it became less feasible legislatively in the first 100 days? Because it seems as though, in addition to the fact that Roosevelt took office in the midst of an economic and social cataclysm, Congress has also become much more of a complex operation than it was back then. In your piece, you write that federal government was a small and ramshackle enterprise in 1933. When does that start to change?
Basically after World War II, and especially after the 1950s. So one of the challenges today is that government is just much, much larger and much more complex. And as I said, you know, today we're not talking about writing laws that have never existed before. We're usually talking about renovating laws or big bureaucracies.
Well, it also strikes me that a lot of the increased complexity and bureaucracy of the federal government is a result of FDR's presidency, right? I mean,
Well, that's right. FDR and you know, and post-war presidents as well, right?
Yeah.
Steadily expanding the remit of the federal government.
So, Professor Roberts, you wrote this piece that we have been talking about in 2021 at the beginning of President Biden's term, and you wrote that 100 days was a misguided standard to judge Biden or any president by, because even though Biden was facing a crisis, it was more of a crisis of national unity rather than a crisis on the order of what Roosevelt was facing. And Trump, in his second presidential campaign, much like in his first one, very much campaigned on the idea that America is a nation in crisis. And as we've been talking about, as a result of that, he has moved very aggressively with executive orders in his first 100 days. What do you make of his approach?
Well, I think, you know, the key difference is that President Trump may say there's a crisis, but there's no broad consensus on that there is a crisis or what the crisis is. And that's a qualitative difference from earlier periods. And the problem with the 100-day benchmark is it basically says to incoming presidents, go in there and sort of tear things up as fast as you can.
I think a lot of people would argue that Trump has taken a, to quote you, tear things up approach in his first 100 days. How impactful do you think it's been? I mean, he obviously hasn't passed as many bills as Roosevelt did, but how would you contextualize it historically?
It's going to be tough. I think a lot of what he's doing is being done through discretionary powers given to the president. And one of the difficulties is that if it's a discretionary power, any future president could undo it. So, for example, there's talk about removing the Department of Education, but that requires legislative action. If there's no legislative action, a president down the road could breathe life back into the Department of Education. So it could be that some of this, ephemeral might not be the word to use, but it might be that a lot of this could be reversed by a future president. But the aggressive talk toward other countries, the reversals in trade policy have severely damaged relations with other countries. And that is unlikely to be repaired quickly. That's damage that's going to persist for decades.
Well, speaking of legacy, how much do you think the actions of a president in the first 100 days, which, as we've been talking about, tend to get a tremendous amount of focus in that initial sprint, how much do you think the accomplishments or lack thereof in those first 100 days stick to the historical memory of a president?
Well, the irony is that if President Trump and his advisors really wanted to sort of lay down a historical legacy, the prudent path would have been to forget about the 100 days, think carefully about what their priorities are, and focus on those priorities, lay a legislative foundation for what they want to do so that the changes that they were making are durable. What they've done in this sort of rush to meet the kind of 100-day deadline, much of it has been chaotic, it's been error-prone, and it may well evaporate quickly. So the prudent path would have been to forget the 100 days and just focus on a longer-term agenda.
Well, Alistair Roberts is a public policy professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, giving us this important context on the first 100 days. Professor Roberts, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Arizona health officials reported nearly 11,000 cases of valley fever in 2023, the most recent year for which data are available. Valley fever is a lung infection caused by a fungus that grows in the soil and is most common in Arizona, California, and other parts of the southwestern U.S. But new research suggests dogs may be able to help give us a better sense of how prevalent the disease actually is. Jane Sykes is a professor of small animal internal medicine at the University of California, Davis. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about what she found. And they started with what this research says about what dogs can tell us about valley fever that we don't already know.
Yeah, so as you may be aware, valley fever is a disease that's considered to be emerging in people, and certainly concerns about changes in our climate and contributing to increasing valley fever in people. And so there's been a lot of concern and certainly some modeling efforts to suggest that by 2035, even as much as half of the Western United States may have valley fever. And unfortunately, currently, the reporting of valley fever is not required for all states in people. And so we have states that we know that are endemic for the fungus, like Texas, for example, where there's no reporting information available. Whereas with dogs, you know, we have been able to collect the results of antibody tests, serology tests, which is the main way the disease is diagnosed in dogs, that have been archived at this very narrow set of laboratories that actually performs this specialized testing. And so that's allowed us to capture results for dogs right across the entire country, including in these states that don't report human disease. And so we've been able to get really good information from hundreds of thousands of dog test results from these regions. And because dogs don't travel as much as people, actually, even if we were able to get that information for people, it would be more complicated by travel than it is in dogs.
So basically what you're saying is we have better information on how many dogs have valley fever and where they are than we do for humans?
Exactly, that's right.
So how are we able to use that? Like, are you able to look at the results from dogs and say, okay, there's X number in, say, Texas, so we can maybe extrapolate that out and say there might be X number of human cases in that state?
Exactly. And so one of the findings from our study is that where we do know human disease happens, like in California and Arizona, where there is quite good reporting information for people, we were able to compare the results of the dog test results to human reported data and show that there was a very strong correlation between those case numbers. And we normalized the dog data to population, so per 10,000 households. The other thing that makes dog information useful is that there are a lot of dogs in the United States. And, you know, it's now estimated that about 45% of U.S. households have at least one dog. So when we were able to use the households as a denominator, you know, that helps to control for population numbers, and very close correlation between case numbers in people in California and in Arizona, which suggests that probably is the same for other states where we don't have human information. And so our future work is looking at those areas where we don't have information in humans and trying to extrapolate as to what's likely based on the dog data.
How reliable do you think that might be able to be in places like maybe Texas or Oregon or Washington State, where there have started to be more cases of valley fever? Like, do you think you'll be able to look at the number of dogs and maybe have to increase the number of dogs that are tested in those places to try to get a gauge of what the human situation might be?
Yeah, and interestingly, in Washington, before human cases were recognized in Washington State, the Washington State Disease Diagnostic, Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory noted that there had been cases in dogs and also a horse in Washington before disease was recognized in people. And they now have a requirement, the state requirement for reporting of animal cases. And, you know, when we looked at our data, there were a number of states that seemed to have really quite a higher incidence of dog disease when compared with other states that probably had, you know, kind of low incidence of disease because of travel. You know, states like East Coast states where we really know the fungus isn't present, but there were some Western states that had really a huge jump in incidence relative to those other states where we really don't think the fungus exists. And some of those states were states that we really don't recognize as being endemic for valley fever in humans at this point in time. And I think that's a sign that the fungus is present in those locations.
That's interesting. So it's possible that valley fever might be more widespread than we think it is. And the way we might be able to figure that out is through dog infections.
Exactly. Yeah. So states like Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho, Oregon all had, you know, these higher incidences that might be a sign that the disease is occurring in people in those regions, not as a result of travel to endemic states.
So I know that one of the issues with valley fever, especially as it relates to humans, is that there are some number of doctors who just don't know to even look for it or test for it because it's, you know, a lot of people can have it and it never manifests itself. They never show symptoms, anything like that. Is that also the case with dogs? Like, are vets ready and knowledgeable enough to test for it if they know a dog is from a particular area and maybe has particular symptoms?
Yeah, so, you know, we have the same problems for dogs as exist in people, and it is under-recognized in some parts of the country. And sometimes I get calls from veterinarians working in Florida, for example, who have just diagnosed the disease in a dog that's been traveling to Arizona. So there are some vets that are aware of it and some that are not. And unfortunately, we do see cases referred to us here at UC Davis, oftentimes that have been treated with antibacterial drugs, antibiotics when they need antifungals, because no one's thinking about valley fever. So this is a really good opportunity to increase awareness of the disease and have people be looking out for it in these states where we think it might be present.
So I would imagine then that for someone who does the kind of work that you do, having a more accurate gauge of how many dogs and people are actually infected with valley fever would probably be pretty helpful.
Very much so. Yes. Yes. And the other thing about dogs that we've found is that one of the risk factors for valley fever in dogs is digging in the dirt. And, you know, dogs have this tendency to dig. It brings them very close to the soil. And so it means that they're, you know, they're often getting infected and more susceptible to infection maybe than people in the same region. And so that makes them good, what we call sentinels for the disease, kind of like the canary in the coal mine, if you will.
Yeah, that is really interesting. All right, that is Jane Sykes, a professor of small animal internal medicine at the University of California, Davis. Jane, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.